Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm David Finkel, Artistic Director of Music at Menlo. Along with Artistic Co-Director Wu Han, Artistic Administrator Patrick Castillo, and some of this season's festival artists, it is my pleasure to introduce you to Music at Menlo's 2010 season, Maps and Legends. In 2004, the festival's second season, we embarked on a musical odyssey with stops in five singular musical regions. This season, we expand on that journey to explore music from a spectrum of remarkable times and places, from the rich musical traditions of Vienna, England, and Spain, to Dvorak's America, 1920s Paris, and beyond. Maps and Legends will offer listeners many layers of context in which to engage with a broad spectrum of great music. This season's audio notes are designed to illuminate some of these layers. Over the course of this summer's concerts, encounters, and other festival events, we'll only continue to discover more of the innumerable connections that make the chamber music literature so rich. This disc juxtaposes two of this summer's concert programs, The English Voice and Vienna. Both programs celebrate a distinguished musical heritage, but the musical traditions of England and Vienna have taken dramatically different courses. For nearly two centuries, from the dawn of the classical period in the early 1700s until around the outbreak of the First World War, Vienna was, without question, the epicenter of the musical world. The city was a cauldron of innovation, fostering the development of the classical style, romanticism, and the early 20th century avant-garde. Vienna fueled the imaginations of some of Western music's greatest composers, from Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven to Johannes Brahms and Arnold Schoenberg. During this time, while Vienna flourished, England fell silent. The transition from the Baroque to the classical period had extinguished the English voice. England's musical landscape was primarily populated by expatriate composers like Haydn and Felix Mendelssohn. That all changed when an intrepid generation of English composers at the turn of the 20th century spearheaded a musical renaissance, and England shed its label of a land without music. Music at Menlo's second and third concert programs this summer feature some of the finest masterpieces in the chamber music repertoire. Beethoven's Serioso Quartet, Brahms' String Sextet, Opus 36, Edward Elgar's thrilling piano quintet, and more, heard in the context of the evolution of two fascinating cultural histories.
Concert Program 3 honors the hallowed musical tradition of Vienna. From the early 18th century to the dawn of the 20th, Vienna was the capital of the musical world. It was the engine that propelled music's evolution from the classical era through the 19th century to the fierce modernism of Arnold Schoenberg and the Second Viennese School. The program begins with Joseph Haydn, the father of the classical style. Following Haydn, we'll hear music by his prize pupil, Ludwig van Beethoven, who ushered Western music from the classical period into the age of Romanticism. At the height of Romanticism came Johannes Brahms, whose String Sextet in G major, Opus 36, ends the program. The program also features Schoenberg's first chamber symphony, in an arrangement by his student and one of the most significant Viennese composers of the 20th century, Anton Webern.
By the mid-18th century, a new aesthetic in music had begun to emerge. The advent of this new direction coincided with the Age of Enlightenment, during which established cultural norms were questioned and challenged. Such leading thinkers as Voltaire and Rousseau preached the virtues of reason, intellectual freedom, and the rights of the individual. The influence of the aristocracy declined, while the authority of religious doctrine gave way to the rise of humanism. Enlightenment values inevitably infiltrated the music of the 18th century. composers adopted new ways of thinking about form and symmetry. Reflecting the period's humanist ethos, the music of the classical period also took on a newly communicative quality. A sense of conversation between individual voices became salient, especially to chamber music. In the chamber works of Haydn and Mozart, we find a perfect balance between musical ideas and emotional expression.
Also during this time, composers experimented with new musical structures and instrumental colors. The birth of sonata form represented a new philosophy on how one could develop musical ideas. Sonata form became a standard musical structure throughout the classical and romantic periods. We encounter it in the works of virtually every composer of the 18th and 19th centuries. Sonata form comprises three distinct sections: the exposition, the development, and the recapitulation. These three sections respectively introduce, transfigure, and return to the central musical ideas or themes contained in a piece of music. We'll revisit sonata form in more detail later. For now, what's worth emphasizing is that it was through Joseph Haydn's innovations that sonata form essentially came into being. The structure's dramatic principles of departure, transformation, and return, or of conflict and resolution, rendered sonata form an exceptionally effective way to humanize musical ideas, so much so that composers commonly return to it even today.
The artistic life of Joseph Haydn embodies the breadth of the classical era. When he was born in 1732, the Baroque period had reached its apogee. Over the course of Haydn's life, and indeed largely by his own hand, what has since become known as the classical style would grow to maturity. By the time of Haydn's death in 1809, his student Beethoven had begun to forecast the Romantic movement with his bold artistic individualism. Haydn's excellence in every prevalent musical genre of the day rendered him the most celebrated composer of his generation. Noting his seminal role as the father of both the symphony and the string quartet, two of Western music's quintessential media since the 18th century, musicologist James Webster writes that, quote, "No other composer approaches Haydn's combination of productivity, quality, and historical importance in these genres. In the 20th century, he was understood primarily as an absolute musician, but earnestness, depth of feeling, and referential tendencies are equally important to his art." End quote.
He just knew no bounds, this man.
Violinist Georgia Flizanis.
The depth of his invention and his originality is staggering, as we all know, and his sense of humor is remarkable, and almost the sensibility of his writing. His craft is gigantic. It's like it's a giant emporium of all that is possible. Like it's almost like a giant cookbook on classical language. And, I mean, it's a workshop unlike any I can imagine, that just idea upon idea.
In addition to being the chief innovator of the classical style, Haydn was remarkably prolific. His oeuvre includes 29 piano trios, at least 47 keyboard sonatas, and possibly more than 70, nearly 70 works for string quartet, and over 100 symphonies, among countless works across numerous other genres. One result of the incredible scope of Haydn's productivity, which is both fortunate and unfortunate, depending on how you look at it, is that in the shadow of his most famous pieces, there is a plethora of music that hasn't entered the standard repertoire, and is all too rarely heard. Or, for those who prefer the glass half full, there is always more Haydn waiting to be discovered.
He just wrote and wrote and wrote, and, you know, and it's amazing how little we really wrap ourselves around the repertoire. I mean, it's hardly, so few of the symphonies. I mean, it's a remarkable, It's depressing, actually, I have to say, how little we know of him. Yeah, I mean, with a prolific composer, you really have to understand. It's up to you to learn more about it if you really choose to and dig around in the corners. And obviously, this concertino is in one of those corners that we just don't have any light shining in.
This summer, we'll hear one of these rarely performed works by Haydn, his keyboard concertino in F major.
Stuff that really, again, opens up the context of where Beethoven came from, how that influenced him. And I mean, this, all this carrying of musical tradition through the ages is, that's a whole fascinating subject.
In 1792, the 21-year-old composer and piano virtuoso Ludwig van Beethoven traveled from his native Bonn to Vienna. The immediate impetus for this move was the opportunity to study with Haydn, but Beethoven's ultimate intention was to establish himself among Europe's musical elite. Mozart, Beethoven's boyhood idol, had died only the previous year. Upon Beethoven's departure from Bonn, his friend and patron, Count Waldstein, wrote to the young composer, "You are going to Vienna in fulfillment of your long frustrated wishes. The genius of Mozart is still mourning and weeping over the death of her pupil. She found a refuge but no occupation with the inexhaustible Haydn. Through him, she wishes once more to form a union with another. With the help of assiduous labor, you shall receive Mozart's spirit from Haydn's hands." Beethoven would remain in Vienna for the rest of his life. And by the time of his death in 1827, he had profoundly altered the course of Western music. The totality of his artistic accomplishment was so transformative that an entire generation of composers was left wrestling with how to respond. Brahms famously struggled for 14 years with his first symphony, so impossibly high was the bar set by Beethoven's Ninth. "You don't know what it means to the likes of us," Brahms once said, "when we hear his footsteps behind us." Beethoven's music is commonly classified into three creative periods. There are the early pieces that he composed in Bonn and during his first few years in Vienna, which most clearly bear the classical imprint of Haydn and Mozart. Beethoven's middle period pushed the boundaries of the classical tradition. In 1803, he said to a friend, "I am not satisfied with what I have composed up to now. From now on, I intend to embark on a new path." This next chapter in Beethoven's artistic journey, which history has dubbed his heroic period, produced music of unprecedented magnitude. It was also during this time that the composer's worsening deafness became a personal crisis. Beethoven responded with music that was epic and defiant. In his final years, Beethoven again pursued a new direction. The music composed in the last decade of his life was extraordinarily ambitious in scope, in turns mystifying and transcendent. The piano sonatas, string quartets, and other works from Beethoven's late period reached new heights and continue to inspire listeners two centuries later. About one of Beethoven's final compositions, the Grosse Fuge, Igor Stravinsky said, quote, It is an absolutely contemporary piece of music that will be contemporary forever. End quote.
Beethoven's String Quartet in F minor, Opus 95, marks the transition from the composer's heroic style to his late period. It is the 11th of his 16 string quartets, which collectively represent a cornerstone of the chamber music literature. In its unrestrained expressivity, the Opus 95 quartet foreshadows not only Beethoven's own late quartets, but also the aesthetic of the romantic generation that followed him. Owing to its austere character, Beethoven nicknamed the work Quartetto Serioso. The quartet was, in fact, not even originally intended for public performance, but for private appreciation by musicians and connoisseurs. The quartet is a study in brevity. The first movement is especially pithy. It contains all of the components of a proper sonata form movement, the musical form we mentioned earlier in our discussion about Haydn, but concentrated inside about just 4 minutes of music. To quickly review, sonata form begins with an exposition in which the movement's main themes are introduced, followed by the development section where the composer transfigures the themes, and then the recapitulation in which the themes return. Here's a quick sketch of the Serioso Quartet's first movement. The aggressive first theme. A rolling, lyrical second theme. A coda to the exposition, which combines elements of both themes. Development section. Recapitulation, where the main themes return. And then a concluding coda. With those signposts to listen for, let's hear the entire first movement. This is the shortest first movement that Beethoven ever composed. The first movements of Beethoven's three Opus 59 quartets, composed just 5 years prior to the Serioso, are all more than twice as long. Thank you. Within the framework of sonata form, composers during the classical and romantic periods typically constructed fantastic labyrinths for the listener to explore. Each musical idea would be developed at length and reimagined in myriad ways. By contrast, the brevity of this movement represented a novel experiment in craftsmanship. Given its short length, the Serioso Quartet's expressive depth is all the more remarkable. 100 years later, the Viennese composer Anton Webern would intrigue listeners by writing music of extreme concision. His Six Bagatelles for String Quartet, for example, composed between 1911 and 1913, take all of about 3.5 minutes to perform. Arnold Schoenberg wrote about these works, quote, "One has to realize what restraint it requires to express oneself with such brevity. You can stretch every glance into a poem, every sigh into a novel. But to express a novel in a single gesture, joy in a single breath, such concentration can only be present in the absence of self-pity." End quote. That these words could just as well have applied to the Serioso Quartet a century before is a testament to the breadth of Beethoven's vision.
We'll leave the rest of Beethoven's Serioso Quartet for you to discover at the concert. The program continues with Western music's most notorious iconoclast, Arnold Schoenberg. Schoenberg was born in Vienna in 1874, at the height of the Romantic period. His early works were deeply influenced by the German Romantic tradition of Brahms, Richard Wagner, and Gustav Mahler. Pieces like his string sextet for Klärte Nacht, composed in 1899, betray this influence with their lush, chromatic harmonies and expressive lyricism. But Schoenberg's legacy is his subsequent development of a radically new compositional technique. In the first decade of the 20th century, his music, already densely chromatic, became increasingly so. In 1908, he became the first composer to completely abandon tonality. Music composed in a tonal language is oriented around a single key. For example, Beethoven's Serioso Quartet is in the key of F minor. And that tonality, F minor, is the quartet's home key. It serves as a frame of reference for the rest of the piece. But in 1908, Schoenberg turned Western music on its ear by defying this fundamental musical premise. That year, he composed his second string quartet, whose last movement was not in any key. From this point, Schoenberg's musical language strayed further and further from conventional tonality. By the early 1920s, he had devised the 12-tone method. Instead of being oriented around a certain key, like C major or F minor, 12-tone music is based on what's called a tone row, a specific ordering of all 12 notes of the chromatic scale. So instead of the frame of reference for a piece of music being F minor, which only includes some of the 12 notes, and where one note, F, is clearly the most important note. Instead, the frame of reference would be a sequence of all 12 notes, for example, where all 12 pitches are of equal importance. Schoenberg's revolutionary new compositional method was taken up by his students Anton Webern and Alban Berg. This triumvirate of composers, unified by their pursuit of a new modern aesthetic, became known as the Second Viennese School, the implication being that they were the heirs apparent of a First Viennese School, comprising Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven. After Schoenberg developed the 12-tone system, he made the famous proclamation, quote, "I have made a discovery which will ensure the supremacy of German music for the next 100 years," end quote. That prophecy hasn't quite come true in the sense that Germany's composers haven't exclusively had the same stronghold on Western music that they did during the classical and romantic periods. But Schoenberg's innovations laid the groundwork for 20th century music. The work of some of the most important avant-garde composers of the last 50 years, composers like Pierre Boulez, Karlheinz Stockhausen, and Milton Babbitt, would be unthinkable without the influence of Schoenberg. For the startling degree of invention exhibited in his work and the weight of his influence on countless other composers, Schoenberg remains a vital figure in the history of Western music.
Schoenberg composed his Chamber Symphony No. 1, Opus 9, in 1906. It reflects the period of his career just before he abandoned tonality, when he was extending the romantic idiom towards a more abstract, expressionist language. But he regarded this work as enough of a personal artistic breakthrough that, upon its completion, he said to his friends, quote, "Now I have established my style. Now I know how I have to compose," end quote. Given Schoenberg's historical reputation as the composer of thorny atonal music, the language of the chamber symphony might at first be unexpected. Thank you. In considering the evolution of Schoenberg's musical language, Michael Steinberg has written, quote, "Something that did not change was Schoenberg's artistic personality and his temperament. From Verklärte Nacht to the last scores, passion is a constant, and the most immediate and ultimately overwhelming impression the Chamber Symphony No. 1 makes is that of urgent, ardent, even wild utterance." End quote.
In some way, it's quite representative of Schoenberg throughout his life.
Pianist Gilbert Kalisch.
If you think of Verklärte Nacht, you could say to yourself, wow, this guy could have been an immensely successful composer with the public in sort of any medium or idiom that he chose. And he was a man of immense vanity and immense principle, and went on a path that he felt was honorable, where he thought music should be going. This is a very early work, the Chamber Symphony. I think it comes very much out of the tradition that Verklärte Nacht comes out of. And yet, throughout his life, he put music together that had incredible dance movements, even in very strict serial music. So I think he never left his roots.
Schoenberg originally composed the Chamber Symphony for an ensemble of 15 wind and string instruments. He later decided to expand it into a full orchestral work, which has become its most commonly known incarnation. This summer, we'll hear another version of the Chamber Symphony, an arrangement by Schoenberg's student Anton Webern for the reduced instrumental forces of flute, clarinet, violin, cello, and piano.
There's a certain element that is in this arrangement of Webern that is surprising when we think of Schoenberg as a composer of severe music, of intellectual music. But I think I remember Eugene Lehner, who was a renowned, revered violist. He was in love with the Schoenberg quartets. He thought they were the most lyrical, lovely, beautiful musical works. And so hearing and knowing this work, it comes out of his earlier style when he was not writing, when he had not yet explored an experimental compositional medium. But it's kind of consistent with, I think, who he was his whole life, that he's a Viennese composer, and Beethoven and Brahms are the people that he reveres and that are the people that he is a descendant of. This is not forbidding music. It's hard music. It can be angular, and it's certainly not like Brahms. It's a far cry from Brahms, and yet Brahms was dead only a few years when he wrote this. So it's a very, very adventurous in that sense and path-breaking, yet it comes very much out of that tradition.
The program concludes with music by Johannes Brahms. In the decades following Beethoven's death in 1827, composers forged a new musical language. This language, built on the classical tradition and presaged by Beethoven's late works, was founded on the principle of intense personal expression. Composers of the Romantic generation, like Felix Mendelssohn, Robert Schumann, and Johannes Brahms, wrote music characterized by its bold subjectivity and emotional extremes. Georgia Flizanis.
They were the ones that I think that broadened our idea of romanticism by the nature of the expressivity, which is unbound and sometimes with, in the case of Brahms, this clarity of taking classical language but vitaminizing it and enriching it and using certain methods that were very keen to him, which is to take melodic lines that are usually ravishing and balanced and giving them an environment where he could present it with great simplicity in all the environment around it, all the harmony and all the sort of rhythmic nature underneath it, and then take this same simple picture and make it larger and larger and bring it to incredible climactic moments, but always have the simplicity of it be very much essential to his language.
Born in Hamburg in 1833, Brahms succeeded Beethoven, Schubert, and Schumann as the torchbearer of the Viennese tradition. His career represents the apex of the Romantic period. Brahms's oeuvre spans the standard classical genres, from intimate piano miniatures, solo sonatas, and Lieder, to full orchestral works. As mentioned earlier, he struggled for more than a decade to complete his first symphony, but eventually found his voice in this medium and went on to compose three more. But for his entire career, Brahms thrived in writing for small forces. Musicologist Walter Frisch has written, quote, "Brahms revived chamber music after the death of Schumann and defined it for the later 19th century. Across 40 years, from the piano trio Opus 8 to the clarinet sonatas Opus 120, ranges a corpus of 24 complete works that is arguably the greatest after Beethoven," end quote.
Brahms composed his string sextet in G major, Opus 36, between 1864 and 1865. It is his second essay in the string sextet genre, following his B-flat sextet of 1860.
The Brahms second sextet is actually one of my favorite pieces to play.
Violinist Aaron Keefe.
It's not as famous as the first sextet that he wrote earlier, but it has much more of a pensive and sort of melancholy feel to it, whereas the first sextet is much more outgoing. This is much more inward and reflective, I think. It's amazing writing. Even though he was still young when he wrote it, he was amazing at bringing out certain textures and this dense string writing. He really knew how to get the best out of like a string sound. The opening of the piece starts with a sort of mysterious motive in the viola. He just alternates between two notes, sort of like a slow trill. And then the first violin comes in with this gorgeous melody, and it's written as mezza voce, which means middle voice. So it's not supposed to be completely extroverted and outgoing. It's more sort of a hushed inward quality.
He really introduced, I think, some unusual ideas about string skill in this piece, which is, I think, just this whole opening little oscillation that you hear of two strings next to each other that starts the whole ripple, kind of a little rippling sound. It's really like the most obvious version of a naturalistic setting that I think is very much a romantic idea of nature as part of the great expression of humanness. And it's very simple what he thought, but it's totally provocative, maybe in that sense very contemporary sounding, because it took something that was not really, I think, ever done quite to the degree that he did it, and he uses it as a whole running texture through the whole first movement. So you have this this idea of one note oscillating back and forth, and it's sweet, it's gentle, and there is this unbelievable gentleness to Brahms, too.
This piece was actually written during a time in his life when he was sort of infatuated with this woman named Agatha.
This was the amateur soprano Agatha von Siebold.
And she wanted more of a commitment, and he didn't want to get married, and so they had to break off their relationship. And he was sort of devastated because he was really madly in love with her. So this is sort of like a dedication. This whole piece is a dedication to Agatha. And he even spells out her name later in the first movement and the second theme.
The note B natural in German notation is spelled H. Dropping the T, Brahms spells Agatha's name, A-G-A-T-H-E, in the movement's second theme, A-G-A-H-E.
And it was said that after he was done writing this piece, it was sort of like a catharsis, that he finally got over his obsession with his lover.
This music has, again, a certain sweep and a certain jovialness that is always close, especially that first one is what I'm referring to now, is always very couched in this just real serene music.
The second movement is the scherzo movement, and it's rather gloomy. It's in a minor key. But in the middle, you get the sort of outgoing scherzo that we usually are used to hearing. It's in a major key. It's sort of folksy in character.
From there, you go into music that is, again, his slow music, which has always, I think, a kind of moment for us to all sense a seriousness that is not heavy, but always laden with some sort of pain, some pain that is either a sense of loss or some kind of unreachable place.
Thank you.
The final movement begins with a breathless gallop of 16th notes before quickly settling into a more relaxed musical idea, crooned by the first violin in its lowest register. The quick 16th note figure returns in the first violin, while the cello introduces the movement's second theme underneath. Demonstrating Brahms' steady craftsmanship, as well as his deep admiration of the music of Bach, the movement's development section begins with a fugue.
Beyond just getting into the technical things, I think these sextets, both of them, are a great example of how well he understood writing for strings. Because it's beautiful to work where you have the same instruments in pairs, and that idea of just the two of the same instrument being able to both work as dual sounds, but then breaking out and working in sort of trios. That idea, he works beautifully with that. So you have this sweetness of pairs, and then this idea of crisscrossing over and having these wonderful inner voice dialogues that just, it's just fascinating. It's fascinating for the listener, I think, to watch these pairs break into grouplets and then to sense the richness of this whole. Really, in a way, it's probably the chocolatiest and most yummy of sounds. Yeah, but this is real chocolate. This is the 70% dark stuff.